long. Then there was the unidentified one, star with an arrow through it. He would have to find out what that one meant, because that one looked to be the most recent. Decker could tell because Hawkins had recently lost weight, probably because of his illness. The other two tats showed signs of his shrinking weight and the corresponding change in the width of his forearm. The star, though, evinced no signs of this, and the markings looked fresher, too. He might have had it done right before he left prison, in fact. And if he'd had this tat put on close to when he was released, it might have held some significance for him at that time. And since Decker had missed there being no muddy footprints in the house, he was determined to not miss anything else on this case. Homicide detectives rarely got do-overs. He wasn't going to screw this one up again. Chapter 12. It wasn't much. Decker was at police headquarters, staring at it. The duffel held a few items of clothing. A bus ticket for Hawkins' ride from prison. A wallet with some cash. Some paperwork from the prison that Hawkins had drawn graffiti over. There was a dog-eared paperback book by a writer Decker had never heard of. It had a garish cover of a man holding a knife against a scantily clad woman's throat. It was straight out of a Mickey Spillane yarn from the 1950s, he thought. There was also a photo in the wallet of Hawkins's daughter, Mitzi. Her last name was now Gardner, Lancaster had found out. She lived in Trammell, Ohio, about a 2-hour car ride from Burlington. She'd been in her late 20s when her father went to prison. Lancaster had also learned that she was now married and the mother of a 6-year-old boy. The picture of Mitzi was from when she'd been in elementary school. Decker knew it was her because Hawkins had written his daughter's name and age on the back of the photo. And Hawkins had written there, "Daddy's little star." That might be the reason Hawkins had the star tat on his arm. The photo obviously represented far happier times for the Hawkins family. Mitzi looked bright and innocent, all cheeks and smiles, as kids did at that age. And then the dream had shattered. She had grown up to be a drug addict and petty criminal to finance her habit. She'd done short stints in jail and longer ones in rehab. The little girl with the limitless future was no more. Yet apparently, she had finally gotten her life together. "Good for you," thought Decker. But he also knew that he would have to talk to her. Her father might have gotten in touch with her after being released from prison. Lancaster walked in and looked at the pile of items on the table.
"Nothing?"
Decker shook his head. "Got a question."
"Okay."
Lancaster sat down and popped a stick of gum into her mouth.
"Stick to the gum and quit the smokes," advised Decker.
Her lips pursed.
"Thanks, Dr. Decker. So, what's your question?"
"Who called it in?"
"What?"
"Who called in the disturbance at the Richards' house that night?"
"You know, we never found out the answer to that."
"Well, I think we need to find it out now."
"How?"
she said incredulously.
"It's been too long."
"At the time, I read the transcript of the call and listened to the recording as well. The caller was a female. She said she'd heard a disturbance at the house. The cops were sent out and arrived shortly thereafter. Then so did we once the homicides were confirmed."
"That we know."
"But how did the caller know there was a disturbance? The call didn't come from the landlines at the neighboring homes. It didn't come from any traceable cell phone. So where?"
"I guess we weren't too focused on that. We just thought it was a good Samaritan passing by."
"A convenient Samaritan, anyway, and one who was passing by in a monsoon down a dead-end road? Why go down there unless you lived there?"
Lancaster thought about this for a few moments.
"And then once we got there, all signs pointed to Hawkins once you found the print."
Decker nodded because he knew this was true, and it was grating on him beyond belief.
"Okay," he said. "We need to go over this case from square one. No predisposition that Hawkins was good for it. Fresh eyes, wide open."
"Decker, it's been over 13 years.
I don't care if it's been 1,300 years, Mary, he snapped. We need to make this right.
She studied him for a long moment.
You're never going to get over it, are you?
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do.
Decker stared at her moodily.
I need you 100% on this.
Okay, Decker. But please keep in mind that I've got a slew of other cases to work on, not just Hawkins's murder.
Decker scowled.
This has to be your priority, Mary. If the guy really didn't do it, we screwed his life up, sent him to prison where it looks like he was raped, and then let somebody murder him.
We didn't let anyone murder him,
she retorted.
We might as well have, Decker shot back.
Problem?
They both looked over at Jameson standing in the doorway. Lancaster finally drew her gaze from Decker.
Just two former partners having a discussion.
She turned back to Decker.
I'm sorry, Amos. I will work this case as much as I can with you, but my plate is pretty damn full.
What about your saying it was good working together, like old times?
We don't live in old times. We live in the present.
She paused and added,
At least I do, because I don't have a choice.
Decker gazed at her stonily. Jameson said,
Decker, have you heard back from Bogart?
He still hasn't called you?
No. But he's good with us staying here and working on the case?
No, he's not. So you better pack up and head back to D.C.
When did you hear that?
Decker didn't answer.
Decker?
A while back.
And you didn't think to mention it?
I'm mentioning it now. I'll see you back in D.C. at some point.
But you mean you're staying. Decker, you can't.
Watch me.
He stalked out. Jameson looked down at Lancaster, who sat in the chair, still slowly chewing her gum.
What the hell is going on with him?
Jameson said.
If he disobeys orders, he's going to blow up his career at the Bureau.
Lancaster stood.
Amos Decker has always had priorities, but his career has never been one of them.
I know. He just wants to find the truth. He always says that.
Lancaster glanced toward the door.
I actually think he just wants to find some peace. And all of this...
She paused and looked around the room.
All this is just how he survives, with more guilt on his shoulders than any person has a right to bear. And what happened to Merrill Hawkins just added a shitload more. Because he obviously blames himself for what happened. It's just how he's wired. God, I wish I'd never told Hawkins where Decker was.
She touched Jameson on the shoulder.
It was good to see you, Alex.
Lancaster followed Decker out, leaving Jameson alone. Chapter 13. Decker sat on a red park bench in the town of his birth, Burlington, Ohio, warts and all. It had been crushed when most of the factories closed up decades before. Then it had made a comeback of sorts. Then the recession had come and knocked it down again. Now it was slowly coming back. He wondered when the next knockdown would come. It always seemed to. Jameson had sent him a half dozen texts after she'd left town, and he'd ignored them all. Part of him felt bad about this. None of this was about Jameson. This was all about Amos Decker, he knew.
You're never going to get over it, are you?
Lancaster's words had ripped into him like that round into Hawkins's brain.
You never are going to get over their deaths, are you, Amos? How can you? It was your fault.
He had sat on this bench before, just as now, when fall was speedily giving over to winter in the Ohio Valley. Back then, he'd been making a feeble living as a private investigator. He'd been sitting here awaiting a man and a woman who were headed toward a cocktail lounge that was no longer in business. He had been paid by the woman's wealthy father to convince the con artist creep who had won her heart to leave town. He had been successful, It wasn't that hard, since the man thought himself far smarter and slicker than he actually was. He never counted on running into Amos Decker, who finished him off in a few easy moves of chess play. While waiting for the couple, he had observed those moving around him, making deductions and grafting them onto his memory. He used to refer to his memory as his personal wired-in DVR. Now he had updated the term to fit modern times. "I have a personal cloud in my head where all my data is kept safe and secure until I want to pull it out." Two young men walked past arguing about something. Decker noted the clenched hand of the one on the left, in which years ago there would have been $5 bags of crack. Now, he suspected, the dude had some opioid pills that he was trying to sell. The dude on the right was arguing price, no doubt. In his hand was a fistful of Jackson's, in his back pocket a snort bottle of Narcan. In the event of overdose, which was pretty much inevitable, users were bringing their back-to-life medication with them, so that a passerby could stick it up their nose and give it a squirt. Thus, they would live another day to die once more. Such was life in the 21st century. He floated this image up to his personal cloud and went in search of others. He found it in a woman pulling into a parking space on the street in front of what used to be a service station and was now a CrossFit facility. She climbed out, dressed in tight workout clothes, and slung a bag over her shoulder, her face glued to her smartphone screen and with earbuds in. He looked over her car. The parking permit on her front bumper identified where she lived for any potential bad guy to see and follow. He wanted to tell her to find another way to do the parking thing and not to be so oblivious about her surroundings while she eagerly examined her critically important social media happenings, but he figured she'd just call the cops on him for harassing her. This scene was dutifully uploaded to his cloud for no apparent reason other than it always went there. Last shot. An elderly couple walked by, hand in hand. He looked a bit younger than she, perhaps in his early 80s. Her hand was trembling, and she had a tremor along one side of her face. The other side drooped, either Bell's palsy or she'd previously suffered a stroke. The man had hearing aids in both ears and what looked to be a melanoma growing on his nose, and yet they shuffled slowly along together, growing old, nearing the end, and still in love. That was the way it was supposed to work. Decker tried but failed to not upload that to his cloud. But he did try to stick it in a particularly remote part of his memory. So, with Jameson gone, he was alone again. In some ways, he preferred it. He had been on his own after his family had been taken from him, and he had survived. Maybe it was for the best. Maybe he was destined for a solitary existence. It just felt more comfortable. He shifted his sole focus to the problem at hand. Merrill Hawkins. Decker had approximately 1 million questions and not nearly that many answers. In fact, he had none at all. But he was not parked on this bench merely for his health or for the sake of nostalgia. He had spoken to one widow, Susan Richards. Now he was awaiting another. Rachel Katz walked down the pavement a few minutes later. She and David Katz had never had any children. She lived alone in a condo downtown. It was a luxury loft in an old factory building. Decker had learned that she still worked as a CPA and had her own practice, and she still owned the American Grill. Her office was a 5-minute walk from her loft. Several years younger than her late husband, she was now 44. A striking-looking woman. When Decker had first met her all those years ago, she had aged exceptionally well. Her blonde hair was still long and skimmed her shoulders. She was tall and fit, with a swagger to her walk. She moved like she owned the world, or at least Burlington, Ohio. She was dressed in a black jacket with a white cuffed shirt underneath and a long skirt. Her choice of lipstick was flaming red, her fingernails the same shade. The briefcase she carried lightly smacked against her thigh as she walked. A couple of construction workers catcalled out to her as she passed by. Katz ignored them. Decker heaved himself off the bench and went to work, just like old times. Chapter 14. She looked up at him, recognition flitting across her features as he stopped her on the sidewalk.
I remember you.
Amos Decker. I investigated the death of your husband when I worked on the Burlington Police Force.
That's right.
She frowned.
And I heard on the news that the man who killed him came back to town, and that he was found murdered.
That's right. Merrill Hawkins. She shuddered.
Well, I can't say that I was sorry, but I thought he was in prison for life. What was he doing here? The news didn't say.
They let him out because he was terminally ill with cancer. She had no reaction to this.
And what are you doing here?
She asked. I just have some questions for you.
Do you still work for the police? I thought I heard that you left town.
I work for the FBI now, but I'm still a sworn officer in Ohio. He showed her his official credentials.
And what exactly are you investigating?
Hawkins' murder, and that of your husband and the other victims at the Richards' that night. She shook her head, looking confused.
We know who killed my husband and the Richards family. Merrill Hawkins.
We're taking another look at it.
Why?
There are some anomalies we need to sort out.
What sort of anomalies?
Do you want to go somewhere to discuss this rather than out on the street? Or we can go down to the police station. She looked around at several passers-by, staring at them.
My condo is right over here.
He followed her into the building, which had a concierge, and they rode up in an elevator to her floor. Didn't know they had places like this in Burlington, noted Decker as they walked down the plush corridor. At least they didn't when I lived here.
We just completed this a year ago. I'm actually involved with the development company that renovated this building. We're working on two others, and I'm also working with another group in several new projects around town and a slew of businesses, including some restaurants. We have big plans for Burlington.
Economy finally turning around?
Seems to be. We hope to get several large companies to come here. We're really rolling out the red carpet. Two Fortune 1000s have already started building regional headquarters in the area, and a high-tech startup just opened its headquarters downtown, which brought in a lot of young, affluent people. It's a lot cheaper to live here than in, say, Chicago. And we enticed a hospital system to build a new facility, and we're well along to getting a parts supplier to the Big Three in Detroit to build a new factory on the north side of town. Those people have to live, shop, and eat out somewhere. New restaurants and places to live downtown are already popping up, in addition to what I'm working on. So, yes, things are looking up.
Great. They entered her condo, which had an open floor plan and lots of 20-foot windows. Decker watched as Katz used a remote to open the shades to let in the fading light. Beautiful place, he observed, looking at all the expensive architectural details, like exposed beams and repointed brick walls, slate floors, high-dollar appliances in the kitchen, and oil and acrylic paintings on the wall. The furniture was big enough not to be overwhelmed by the large footprint, with several comfortable seating areas laid out.
It was featured in Lux,
she said.
That's a design magazine,
she added when Decker looked blankly at her.
Targeted to the very affluent.
She paused.
Sorry if that sounded snooty.
No problem. I'm just not very knowledgeable about that stuff, and I've never been affluent.
Well, I wasn't born with a silver spoon. And being a CPA, I work about 100 hours a week.
You must have gotten off early today, then. It's not yet 5. I was expecting to be waiting longer before I saw you coming home.
This is just a little break for me. I head back to the office in a couple hours for a client meeting, and then I have an event later tonight.
I was hoping to catch up on a few domestic chores right now, so if we could get down to what you wanted.
She sat down on a couch and motioned for Decker to sit in a chair opposite.
So, what anomalies were you referring to?
I can't get into specifics because it's an ongoing investigation. I can tell you that Merrill Hawkins came back to town to ask the police to reopen the investigation.
Reopen it? Why?
Because he said he was innocent.
Katz's features turned ugly.
So you're taking the word of a murderer to reopen the investigation? Are you kidding me?
No, not just that. There are the anomalies I mentioned.
And that you won't specify. So what do you want with me?
She said abruptly.
Can you tell me why your husband was there that night?
Good God. I already testified to this.
It would just take a minute, and you might remember something you hadn't before.
Katz let out a long, annoyed sigh and crossed her arms and legs.
It was a long time ago.
Just whatever you can remember, prompted Decker.
Don Richards was the loan officer at the bank, so David knew him. He'd been instrumental in getting the loan for the American Grill construction. My husband was very ambitious. That was one trait that drew me to him. He wanted to make a lot of money and also do things to help bolster the community. I appreciated that.
When did you two meet?
Shortly after the grill opened.
She got a far-off look on her face and smiled.
We were set up on a blind date, of all things. We were both so busy it was hard to find time to meet people. We hit it off right away and were married 6 months later.
And as you said, you still own the American Grill.
Yes, it was in both my and David's names. It passed to me after Hawkins murdered him.
Has it been profitable for you?
We've had good and bad years. Right now it's doing okay.
So, as far as you know, your husband was just there that night to shoot the breeze with Don Richards, or was it about business?
I don't know. I told you that before. I didn't even know he was going over there that night. They might have been talking about some business projects because David had several things going on at that time, and Don was his main contact at the bank. But I don't know why he would have done that at Don's home.
She added icily.
As you know, David never came home alive, so he couldn't tell me what they discussed. I thought we'd be together for life. Turned out it was only for a short time.
Had your husband become friends with Mr. Richards? Did you and his wife hang out with each other?
No. Nothing like that. They had kids, we didn't. And they were older, and David and I were working all the time. We didn't have time for friends, really.
And you were working that night, correct?
I'd just started my own CPA firm. I was burning the proverbial midnight oil.
She frowned.
Until I got the call from the police, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was some awful prank.
She paused and glanced up at Decker.
I had to identify his body. Have you ever had to do that? ID the body of someone you loved?
I'm sure it was very hard, Decker replied quietly.
She suddenly gazed hard at him.
Wait a minute. Oh my God, that happened to you, your family. I remember now it was all over the news.
Doesn't matter, said Decker. Your husband's wallet and wristwatch were missing, and a gold ring with encrusted diamonds he wore.
She nodded.
I gave that ring to him for what turned out to be his last birthday.
She added coldly.
Anything else you can remember that might help me?
I don't want to help you,
she said candidly.
Because Merrill Hawkins killed my husband. We were going to have a family. We were going places. We talked about moving to Chicago. I mean, a place like Burlington can only take you so far.
Then why are you still here?
asked Decker just as bluntly.
My husband is buried here.
Decker's features softened. I can understand that. She stood.
I really need to get going, so if there's nothing else.
Decker rose from his chair. Thank you for your time.
I'm not going to wish you luck. And I'm glad that Hawkins is dead.
One more question. Can you tell me where you were between 11 and midnight on the night Merrill Hawkins was murdered? She blanched.
Do you really believe I had anything to do with his murder?
I don't know. It's why I'm asking. But if you have an alibi, it would be good to get it out there. The police are going to ask you for one.
Why?
Because he was back in town and you believe he killed your husband. If it makes you feel any better, we asked Susan Richards the same thing.
And did she have an alibi?
Decker didn't answer.
When was it again?
She asked, evidently upset. He told her. She stood there rocking back and forth.
I'll have to check my schedule and see what I can find. I'm so busy, I have a hard time remembering what I was doing an hour ago.
As he headed to the door, she called out after him.
Why are you really doing this?
He turned back, his hand on the doorknob. There are enough guilty people in the world without us making an innocent person one.
Do you really think Hawkins was innocent?
She said skeptically. That's what I'm going to find out.
You sound confident. But it's been a long time. Memories fade.
I don't have that problem, said Decker. Chapter 15. He finally answered the phone. He really had no choice. It had now been a while since she'd left town. Hello, Alex.
Well, it's about damn time.
She barked. I've been busy.
So have I. The team's leaving to go to work on a case in New Hampshire. Plane takes off in an hour.
Good luck on it.
Bogart is not happy.
I'm sure he has every right to be pissed at me.
You're just placating me. I was calling to see if you wanted to join us in New Hampshire. I checked on flights. There's one you can catch out of Cleveland with a layover in Newark.
I can't do that, Alex. I'm working the case here.
Well, get in good with your old friends at the police force there. I'm not sure you'll have a job at the FBI when you get back.
I guess I can understand that.
Nobody wants that, Amos. I hope you know that.
I do.
Good luck with everything you're doing up there.
She clicked off, and Decker put down his phone and stared at it for a long moment. He was suddenly hungry, and he knew exactly where he wanted to eat. The place was only about a quarter full when he got there, even though it was the dinner hour. He had noticed some new eateries that had opened up on his walk over here. Maybe they were taking business away from the American Grill. He was shown to a table and sat down. He glanced at his menu and then scanned the interior. Waiters and waitresses were making the rounds of the tables. Other waitstaff stood against the wall, conversing. His gaze passed one table and then came back to it, his attention suddenly riveted on the couple sitting there. It was Earl Lancaster, Mary's husband. He was there with a woman, only it wasn't his wife. Earl had started out as a construction laborer before becoming a contractor. He had the build of a man who used his muscle for a living. He was about 6 feet tall, with a marine buzz cut, thick arms, and a broad chest. He was dressed in an untucked white long-sleeved shirt and dress jeans. A pair of black loafers were on his feet. His companion was in her early 40s with a slim build, long, soft brown hair, green eyes, and a pleasant smile as she peered lovingly into Earl's face. Earl broke off looking at her, gazed around the restaurant, and flinched when he saw Decker staring at him. He said something to the woman, jumped up, and headed over to Decker's table. Decker noted that the woman watched him the whole way. Earl sat down across from Decker.
Amos, I heard you were in town. Mary told me.
Is that right? Said Decker, letting his gaze linger for a moment longer on the woman before looking at Earl. The man seemed embarrassed. He put his hands together on the tabletop and stared down at them.
Guess you're wondering what's going on.
I am, but it's also none of my business.
Well, fact is, Mary and I are splitting up.
Really? Said Decker. I'm sorry to hear that. And who's your friend over there?
Earl glanced up.
I know what you're thinking.
I doubt it.
Mary initiated this whole thing, Amos. It wasn't my idea, but I have a life to live.
What about Sandy?
We're splitting custody, but I'll have her more. Mary's schedule is too crazy.
And she's okay with that?
She suggested it.
What's going on with her? Why the divorce? Why letting you get Sandy? This isn't making sense.
Earl looked uncomfortable.
She's a cop. It's a lot of pressure.
Do you want to get divorced, Earl?
I don't have a choice, do I? It's not like I can stop her.
Decker glanced at the woman again. She smiled, but when he didn't return it, she abruptly looked away.
Well, regardless, I think you've already made your choice.
Earl's features turned angry.
I don't need to be judged by you, okay?
I'm not judging anybody. I'm simply making an observation. If I'm wrong, tell me so, and I'll say I'm sorry.
Earl's anger dissipated.
Look, it's true. Nancy and I are seeing each other. But Mary and I stopped... Well, we stopped living really as husband and wife a while back, if you know what I mean. And I didn't start seeing her until Mary told me our marriage was over. I swear to God.
I believe you. And how is Sandy taking it?
She doesn't really understand.
I think she probably understands more than you think.
We'll get by. We have to.
No argument there. Hope everything works out for you. All of you, he added.
I know why you're in town. Mary told me. The Hawkins case. You know one of the victims, David Katz, owned this place.
Decker nodded.
And now his widow does. You know Rachel Katz?
Yeah, I know her. She's involved in lots of projects around town.
She apparently has big plans for Burlington.
Well, the town needs a shot of energy. Glad she's doing what she's doing.
Okay, said Decker.
I better be getting back. Good to see you, Amos.
Yeah.
Earl retreated to his table, where Decker watched him and the woman named Nancy talking and snatching glances at him. He picked up his menu and waved the waitress over after he'd made his decision. She was in her 30s, tall and skinny. The young man was behind her. She introduced him as Daniel, a trainee. He looked to be in his 20s. With dark hair and sharply defined features. He smiled shyly and then watched the waitress, his order pad held out like hers. When Decker ordered, she smiled and wrote it down.
That's a lot of food.
Well, I'm a lot of guy, replied Decker.
Daniel laughed along with the waitress. When his meal came, he ate it methodically, all the while looking around the restaurant. When Earl and his friend left, they did not look in his direction. For which Decker was glad. He was not adept at these moments. Things he could say before his brain injury were impossible to get out now, even if the underlying emotions were inside him. Or else he would blurt out the wrong thing and make everyone uncomfortable. Mary divorcing. So that was the explanation for her odd behavior. He felt sorry for both Earl and her. Yet he felt sorriest of all for Sandy. He would like to talk to Mary about it. But was afraid he would just botch it. He finished his meal and ordered a cup of coffee. Whenever the door opened, a chilly wind leaked into the space. He would have to get a heavier coat if he was going to stay here much longer. He wasn't that far removed from the days when the only clothes he had were the ones he was wearing. As he was drinking his coffee, a voice said,
"Why do I think you're not really here for the food?"
Decker looked up to see Captain Miller standing next to his table. He was dressed in a suit, but his necktie was loosened. He might have just come from work. He sat down across from Decker.
Decker said, "I saw Earl and his lady friend Nancy."
Miller slowly nodded. "Okay, then you know." I know they're getting divorced, and I heard his side of things, not Mary's.
Then you need to ask Mary for her take if you want to. I suggested that to you back at the police station. So, any startling revelations come to you about this restaurant since you were here last?
The coffee still sucks.
Anything else?
Decker looked around the mostly empty space. Why does Rachel Katz still own it? Chapter 16. Cocoon, thought Decker. At their meeting, Rachel Katz had crossed her arms and legs before settling in to answer his more serious questions. People often cocooned like that when they were getting ready to lie, or at least be evasive. It was as though they were wrapping themselves in themselves to keep everyone else out. It was an instinctual physical reaction with people, and even though it wasn't a foolproof indicator of someone lying, Decker had found it pretty accurate. So, what was she lying or being evasive about? He filed that query away since he had no way to answer it yet. He was presently standing in front of the Richards' old house, but he was looking at another house that was two homes over from the Richards'. This was the only house that was still occupied by the people who had lived here when the murders occurred. Back then, Decker had interviewed them and the other neighbors. Out of that, he had gotten a big fat zero's worth of help. He hoped the second time was the charm, because Decker seriously doubted he would get a third bite at the apple.
Mr. D'Angelo, do you remember me?
Decker stared down at the short, balding, rotund man in his 60s who had opened the door at his knock. Though it was chilly outside, he was dressed in a stained undershirt that emphasized his potbelly, and khaki pants with the zipper partially open. He had a cloth napkin in his hand and was wiping his mouth. He looked quizzically at Decker before recognition breached his features.
You're that detective, Pecker.
Decker, Amos Decker.
Right.
Decker glanced at the napkin.
Looks like I interrupted your dinner. No, we were just finishing up. Come on in.
D'Angelo closed the door behind Decker, whose nostrils were immediately assailed with the mingled aromas of garlic and pesto.
Smells good, he said, as he glanced around the tidy interior. You want some? Ma made plenty, always does.
He playfully grabbed his belly.
Why, I'm so fat. No, thanks, I already ate. Ma, called out D'Angelo, look who's here.
A petite gray-haired woman came out from the kitchen, drying her hands on a dish towel. She wore a full apron over her skirt and blouse.
Mrs. D'Angelo, I'm Amos Decker. I used to work as a detective on the local police force.
That's right. I remember.
She looked him up and down.
Heard you moved?
I did, but now I'm back. At least for a little while.
Well, come in and sit.
Said Mrs. D'Angelo.
Would you like some wine?
Sure, that'd be great. Thanks.
She brought the wine and poured out three glasses, and they all sat in the small living room that held the exact same furniture as the last time Decker had been here.
We're retired now, said D'Angelo. Well, I am. Ma always took care of the kids in the house. Hell, worked harder than I ever did taking care of them.
Now I just have to look after you.
Said his wife with a knowing smile at Decker. D'Angelo said,
We're thinking of selling the place. Kids are all grown and gone off with their own families. Maybe get a condo down in Florida. I can't take too many more Ohio winters. It gets into your bones. I hear you, said Decker.
The couple fell silent and looked at him, apparently waiting for him to explain what he was doing there. Decker felt this curious scrutiny while he sipped his wine.
I suppose you heard about Merrill Hawkins, he began.
D'Angelo nodded.
Strangest damn thing. Thought he was in prison for life. Then he's here, then he gets killed. Is that why you're back? Sort of, yes.
Are you looking for who killed him?
Asked Mrs. D'Angelo anxiously.
Yes, and I'm looking at something else, too.
What's that?
She asked.
If Merrill Hawkins didn't kill your neighbors all those years ago, who did?
The The D'Angelos had both raised their wine glasses to take a sip, and both of them nearly spilled their drinks. D'Angelo said,
"I don't understand. That Hawkins fellow did kill them. That was proven."
"He was convicted of the murders, that's true," said Decker.
"But isn't that the same thing?"
asked Mrs. D'Angelo.
"Usually, yes," conceded Decker. "But not in all cases. I'm taking a fresh look at the case. You two are the only ones left who lived here when the killings took place."
D'Angelo nodded.
"That's right. The Murphys moved to Georgia, and the Balmers retired to, where was it again, hun?"
"Hilton Head."
"And the other house was empty," noted Decker.
"That's right. Been empty for a while. It's empty again, though a couple families have come and gone in between. There was a family moved into the Richards house, but they didn't stay all that long."
"Wouldn't catch me moving in there,"
said Mrs. D'Angelo.
"I'd have nightmares all the time. I did anyway after what happened."
"So that night you reported, you didn't hear or see anything," said Decker.
"That's right," replied D'Angelo. "Raining like crazy, thunder and lightning and the wind. Holy Jesus, I remember it clear as day. We were afraid we'd get a tornado."
"And yet you still managed to fall asleep in front of the TV,"
his wife reminded him.
"We were watching some movie."
"Blade Runner," said Decker. "That's what you said."
"That's right," said D'Angelo, looking impressed. "You got a good memory."
"So nothing you can remember from that night?"
Mrs. D'Angelo said,
"Well, I saw that one car come in. Oh, it was before the storm. I was just finishing making dinner, saw it pass by when I was looking out the window. I told you all that."
"That will be David Katz's car, a four-door Mercedes sedan, silver."
"Yes, that's right. Beautiful car."
"Probably cost more than our house,"
commented D'Angelo.
"And you didn't see him get out of the car when he got to the Richardses?"
"No, where I was standing in the kitchen, my view is blocked by the house in between ours."
"And it was just you and your husband here that night?"
"Yes, our oldest was in college. Our two younger ones were out with friends."
"So no other cars, no sounds from the Richardses. I know you've been asked this before, but if you could think about it again."
"I didn't hear anything from the Richards house, no,"
said Mrs. D'Angelo. Decker was about to move on to another question when something in her voice caught his attention.
"What about one of the other houses?" he asked.
"Well, it was the empty one, just to the left of us."
"So the one closest to the Richardses?"
"Yes. It had been abandoned for a long time. Sometimes you had teens over there doing things, drinking and smoking and..."
"Screwing," said D'Angelo.
"Anthony!"
exclaimed his wife.
"Language!"
D'Angelo grinned and settled back in his recliner.
"Well, they were."
"So it might have been the same that night," said Decker. "Some teens over there. What exactly did you see or hear?"
"It was just a glimpse of movement, really."
She rubbed her temples.
"Oh, it was so long ago."
She looked at her husband.
"But I do think it was a teenager."
"Male or female?"
"Male. At least I think so. It really was just a glimpse."
"And do you remember what time that might have been?"
"Well, it was certainly after the storm had started. I was thinking to myself that they were getting soaked."
"But you don't have a certain time in mind."
"No, I'm sorry."
Decker nodded.
"Okay, I appreciate your making the effort."
He left them there and walked back outside. He didn't know what he could expect all this time later. Most witnesses couldn't remember what they saw yesterday, much less 13 years ago. He walked over to the empty house to which Mrs. D'Angelo had just been referring. He peered into one of the windows but couldn't see much. He tried the door. It was locked. He had no idea who even owned the house. Whoever did wasn't doing much with it. He headed over to the Richards' house and surveyed it. David Katz had driven his car into the driveway and then past the front of the house and behind it. where he had pulled into a small grassy park-off situated there. Decker looked back over his shoulder. From here it would have been impossible for D'Angelo to have seen him get out of the car and go into the house. The other neighbors had reported the same thing. They hadn't seen Katz go into the house where he would later die. And yet it was indisputable that he had. Decker looked down at the ground here. Katz's car's tires had sunk deeply into the ground, what with all the rain. He had driven in before the storm started, so there weren't really traces of his car tires coming onto the property. As Lancaster had earlier pointed out, the rain would have washed those away. But a car coming in after the rain had started should have left some traces. So had the killer walked here, in the driving rain, and left no traces of that inclemency when he had entered the house? It made no sense. But it had to, somehow, because it had happened. His phone buzzed. It was Lancaster.
"I think we got a runner,"
she said.
"We must have spooked her."
"Her? Who is it?"
"Susan Richards."
Chapter 17.
"Hold on. Where's the FBI gal? I liked her."
Agatha Bates was staring up at Decker through the lenses of her thick glasses. Mary Lancaster, who stood next to Decker in Bates's small living room, said,
"She's on another assignment out of state. I'm working with Agent Decker now."
Bates nodded.
"Well, so long as you got somebody to keep an eye on him. He's a strange one,"
she added, as though Decker couldn't hear her.
"I think he's just too big for his own good, if you know what I mean."
Lancaster said to him,
"I had gone over to Richards's house to question her again. The car was gone and there was no answer. Mrs. Bates was out in her yard, called me over, and told me what she saw last night."
Decker glanced out the window across the street at Susan Richards's house.
"What can you tell us?" he said.
"What I told this lady. It was around 9:30 last night. I heard that dang car start up."
"You mean Richards's car with the loud muffler," said Decker.
She frowned up at him.
"I thought I'd just said that."
"Tell him what happened next,"
said Lancaster quickly. Bates slowly drew her gaze from Decker and said,
"Saw Susan get out of the car while it was running and head into the house. She came out a few minutes later with a big old suitcase, one of them rolling ones. She leaned down and opened the car trunk and heaved it in. Then she slammed the trunk shut and got in the car."
"What was she wearing?" asked Decker.
"Long trench coat and a hat, all I could see."
"And you're sure it was her?" said Decker.
"Course I am. I know Susan, tall, thin, blonde hair and all."
Lancaster nodded.
"And then she drove away?"
"That's right. She didn't tell me about taking a trip, but she must be going away for a while. That bag was stuffed."
Lancaster looked over at Decker, who was once more staring out the window. She said,
"Richards must have left in a hurry. She didn't stop the newspaper or mail deliveries I checked."
"So, is she on the lam, then?"
asked Bates.
"What we used to call it when people go on the run, you know, like The Fugitive. I loved that show. Don't make them like that anymore."
Her small face crinkled with pleasure.
"And I had the biggest crush on David Jansen. What a hottie he was. He's dead now. Everybody I liked on TV is dead now."
"We're not sure of her reasons for leaving,"
said Lancaster.
"Well, if Susan killed that man, she probably would try to get away,"
said Bates.
"I know I would."
Decker said,
"Did you see anyone else over there last night?"
Bates's gaze swiveled back to him.
"No, would have told you if I had."
"Nothing out of the ordinary?" he persisted.
Bates thought about this.
"Not unless you count somebody going on the lam."
Decker and Lancaster left and walked across the street to Richards's home. A forensic team was inside looking around. Decker looked to the sky where a storm was coming in. Lancaster followed his gaze.
Weird weather this time of year. It was warm and humid and not a cloud in the sky last night. Now we're going to get a storm and the temp will drop 25 degrees.
Decker nodded absently.
You put out a bolo, right? He said.
Of course, nothing yet. We also tagged her credit cards and her phone, no charges, and she must have turned her phone off.
Someone will probably spot the car, or hear it.
So does this confirm her guilt, vis-a-vis Merrill Hawkins?
Did you check the rear door of the Residence Inn?
Hasn't changed since your time. Still broken, and no CCTV. So, did Richards exact her revenge on Hawkins?
I don't know.
If she's innocent, why run?
Same answer.
So how do we get answers?
We need to know more about Hawkins.
Like what?
Everything.
You mean after he was murdered?
No, before.
How does that help us?
If he didn't kill the Richardses and David Katz, there must have been some reason why the real murderer would pick him to place the blame. We might find those reasons by looking at what he was doing before the murders.
They walked back to their cars. When they reached them, Decker turned to his old partner.
I saw Earl at the American Grill.
She looked surprised and popped in another piece of gum.
Did you? Was he alone?
No.
She nodded.
Did you speak to him?
He came over. We talked about things.
Nuance has never been your strong suit, Decker. And while you're a stone face when it comes to police work, your poker face sucks when it comes to personal matters. He told you about us.
Decker looked at her uncomfortably as the wind picked up around them.
You have time for a drink?
She asked. Decker nodded. He followed her to a bar called Suds. Decker had frequented the place so often after the deaths of his family that the owner had used a Sharpie to write his name on the bar stool on which he always sat. The place was three quarters full as folks drank and ate food from the bar menu. Music played in the background and some pinball machines lined up against one wall kept lighting up and dinging. The smack of pool balls came from another room where patrons could engage in billiards to their heart's delight, so long as they kept ordering drinks and munchies. Decker and Lancaster sat at a high table set against one wall. Decker ordered a beer, and Lancaster a vodka tonic.
You okay with your decision to join the Bureau?
I'm okay with it, said Decker tersely, but I didn't think we came here to talk about me.
Lancaster took a sip of her drink and munched on some nuts from a bowl in front of her.
Life is complicated, at least mine is.
How does that lead to divorce? I thought you and Earl cared for each other.
We do, Decker. It's not really about that.
What else is there?
What people want out of life, for one.
What do you want that's different from what Earl wants?
I want to keep working in law enforcement.
And Earl doesn't want that?
It's hard on him, Decker. It's hard on Sandy. I get that. But all I've ever wanted to be is a cop. I've worked my entire adult life to get to this point. I can't just chuck it, even if I do care for somebody.
So it's an either-or?
It apparently is for Earl, but I'm not blaming him. You know when those monsters left those mannequins at our home dressed up to look like they'd been murdered 2 years ago? It scared the shit out of all of us, but Earl especially took it hard. He couldn't stop talking about it. What if it had been for real? Things changed after that between us, and they've never gone back to what they were.
And what about Sandy? Earl said he's getting more custody than you.
With my job, how could I have done that? It would be way too hard on Sandy. I'm not going to put her through that.
She's your daughter,
And she's Earl's daughter, too. And she has special needs. His job is a lot more flexible than mine. I can't suddenly duck out of a homicide investigation or not show up for court so I can pick her up from school because she's having an episode. I know. I tried. It didn't work. You saw that for yourself.
I did, and I'm sorry. She gave a weak smile.
Apologies. You going soft on me in your middle age?
Doubtful. He took a swig of beer. I'm sorry that my problems intruded into your life. What happened to your family was because of me. She reached over and gripped his hand.
Every problem in the world is not yours to solve. I know you have very broad shoulders, but no one can take on that sort of responsibility. And it wasn't your fault. It was the fault of a couple of very sick people. You know that's true.
Do I? He said. It doesn't feel that way.
You can't live this way, Amos. It's not sustainable.
I never expected to live that long anyway. She withdrew her hand and said coldly,
No one should wish for a shortened life.
I'm not wishing for it. I'm just being realistic.
You've lost weight. You're in a lot better shape than the last time I saw you.
It's not my weight that concerns me. She glanced at his head and frowned.
Problems there?
Does it matter? I'll just keep going until I don't.
I guess we can talk in circles all night.
I'd rather move forward on this case.
So, you mentioned Hawkins' past. Where do you start?
I start with before he allegedly became a murderer.
You mean?
Exactly. Chapter 18. Trammell, Ohio. Decker had never been here, though it was only a 2-hour drive southwest of Burlington. It wasn't that far mileage-wise, but the only way there was mostly over state routes and rural back roads. Trammell's downtown looked just like a photo of his hometown, right down to the dinginess and despair, alleviated by the glimpses of hope in the form of a new business opening and the foundation of a building being dug, and young faces on the sidewalks and late-model cars on the streets. Mitzi Gardner lived in what Decker would call the upscale part of town, made up of large old homes where Trammell's elite had once lived and where the new money had now congregated. They were large and brick with a past century's small windows, immaculately landscaped lawns with mature trees and bushes, and more modern additions tacked on by recent owners. Most had gated front entrances and luxury cars parked in the curved drives. After being buzzed in through the gate, he walked up to the front door, noting the precisely laid out planting beds, though the flowers had withered or else died out as fall deepened to winter. The house's windows were sparkling clean. The brick veneer seemed to have just been power washed, and the front double doors looked like a fresh coat of paint had just been applied to them. Neat, nice, moneyed. All the things Mitzi Gardner had never been when Decker first met her. She'd been an unemployed drug addict and petty criminal who would steal and prostitute herself out to anyone to support her habit. He remembered her as tall, scrawny, and pasty, with needle-tracked arms and a deviated septum from all the snorted coke. Her pupils had been dilated, her movements jerky and largely out of her control. A wreck of a human being. He knocked on the door and immediately heard footsteps approaching. He had phoned ahead. She knew he was coming. When the door opened, Decker could hardly believe his own eyes, or, even more incredibly, his infallible memory. The woman gazing back at him was around 40, tall, shapely, her blonde hair done in such a way as to maximize both its fullness and attractiveness. She wore a pale blue dress that flattered her hips and showed a glimpse of cleavage, a simple necklace with one emerald at the throat, and a large diamond engagement ring and wedding band on her left hand. Her makeup and complexion were perfect. The once destroyed septum had been fully repaired. The eyes held not a hint of dilation.
The teeth were white and perfect, and no doubt veneers, for her drug habit had left her own teeth gray and diseased, he recalled. She must have registered his surprise.
It's been a long time, Detective Decker,
she commented, her full lips curving into a self-satisfied smile at his amazed look.
Yes, it has. I'm glad to see that you've...
turned my life around? Yes, I have. Years of bad choices followed by some far better ones. Would you like to come in?
She led him inside and then to an old-fashioned conservatory at the back of the house, overlooking the pool and manicured rear grounds. A uniformed maid came in with a tray of coffee. Mitzi poured out the coffee after the maid departed.
I assume you'd heard about your father before I contacted you, said Decker, his cup cradled in one big hand.
I saw the news, yes,
she said. As next of kin, you'll probably be called on to make a formal ID. I mean, we know it's him, it's just a formality.
I would prefer not to. In fact, I would prefer to have nothing to do with it.
He is your father.
And he also killed 4 people.
He has no other family left. And there's the matter of burial.
They must have protocols for that when someone can't afford to be buried. Can't they just cremate him?
Decker let his gaze wander around the sumptuous interior of the conservatory.
I guess so, for those who can't pay for it.
I know you must think I'm a terrible person, Detective Decker, but the fact is, I haven't seen